Coaim. Our guest, Dr. Yaba Blay, interviewed 60 people from 25 countries over a two-year period who were used to strangers asking them, "What are you?" or "Where are you from?" While these individuals identified as Black, they didn't fit the stereotype, or as Blay calls it, the black box of skin color, hair type, and facial features. Their stories, along with their portraits, are included in Yaba Blay's new book called One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. The title refers to an outdated law in southern states that if you had 1/32nd of, quote, African black blood, you were black and relegated to second or third class status. Yaba Blay is Drexel University Africana Studies professor. Last year, she was a consulting producer for the CNN documentary series Black in America for the segment titled Who is Black in America? And Yaba Blay, we've been chasing you around and we're happy to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I know this is a longstanding interest of yours, this notion of identity, of things like skin color, hair, facial features. Where did that come from?
You know, it's interesting, as a professor or even as a graduate student, in research methods, we're often taught to be objective, to separate ourselves from whatever it is we're studying so that we can take a non-biased look. And I've always done what's the opposite, which is to center myself in the work. And so most of my work is very reflective of my own life experiences as well as my own interests. And so for me, I'm a first-generation American-born Ghanaian. My parents immigrated to this country in the 60s, and I was born and raised in New Orleans. And so since folks can't see me, I always describe my skin color as reflective of my Ghanaian ancestry.
Meaning what?
Meaning that I'm very dark-skinned. And so if you know anything about New Orleans and the history of New Orleans, skin color is at the forefront of our lived experiences. Historically, society has been segregated, if you will, white at the top, black at the bottom, and a distinct group of folks who self-identify as Creole in the middle. And so within even the African descendant community, privilege has often been assigned based upon skin color. And so I was very aware I was dark-skinned when I was coming up.
In fact, you describe in the book, and there's a portrait of you and a bit of your story, being a little girl in New Orleans.
Yes.
And sometimes not being invited to a birthday party. What, because of your skin color? Because
yeah.
You're dark-skinned?
Yeah. Literally. I mean, even I left New Orleans in 2002 to come to Philadelphia. And shortly before then, I had a colleague who I thought was a friend. And she was getting married to a prominent someone in the Creole community. And I didn't get an invitation. Mm-hmm. And I was joking with her, you know, asked her, "Where's my invitation?" And she very frankly said that her mother would pass out if I came to her wedding. And so it was, you know, it was so matter of fact to the extent that it becomes a normal reality for many of us in New Orleans.
But do you think this idea and all the sort of loaded implications of skin color, do you think that's a uniquely American thing? Or do you think it's true around the world that skin color seems to matter so much?
Oh, absolutely. And I always talk about, because when we talk about skin color, I talk about skin color in the context of colorism. And when I talk about colorism, you have to talk about colorism in the context of racism and white supremacy. And that's a global issue, that whiteness has come to represent power all over the world. And so the spectrum of skin colors that it creates, power is predicated upon your proximity to whiteness.
So even in an African country, for instance, you see the same thing.
Sure, you can. Mm-hmm.
In fact, you've done some researching in Ghana about skin bleaching.
Yes. Yes, that was my dissertation research, where you have, I mean, it's up to epidemic proportions at this point. You have women and men who use caustic chemicals to lighten the color of their skin. And so many times when we talk about skin bleaching, people, you know, they'll gasp and they'll say, "Well, why would they do that? I can't understand." And it's really about the ways in which, again, power and privilege is predicated on skin color, that in their lived experiences, in their observations, people who get ahead in society, for women, you know, other women who are seen as beautiful, all of these things, they relate to skin color. And so skin bleaching represents their attempt to have some access to that.
And either being treated differently or treated better or feeling that.
Feeling that.
The kind of access to that kind of status.
Yes. It's really about their perception of those things.
Your book is called One Drop. And
yes,
of course, this is a very loaded word in this country with deep history. What does that mean, One Drop?
Well, the title is a nod to this age-old rule, if you will, the one-drop rule, which was a law turned social rule. And so by 1925, most states in this country had some form or another of this rule. And so the one drop rule comes to define blackness as anyone with literally one drop, as little as 1/32nd, meaning one person five generations back, if that person is of African descent, that makes you in this moment black.
Although there, I mean, I don't even know, would a blood test even reveal if, you know, someone's racial heritage?
It wasn't about blood then.
No, I understand that.
Yeah, it's just about mapping out the family tree.
Well, in fact, you include something in your book, What Are You? And it's a Colonial Louisiana Definitions. I'm going to read the definitions. Unfortunately, we can't do justice to the pictures, but you've got Negro. Then you've got Socotra, 7/8 Negro. You've got Griff, G-R-I-F-F-E, 3/4 Negro. Mulatto, half Negro. Quadroon, quarter Negro. Octoroon, 1/8 Negro. Quinteroon, 1/36 Negro. And then Passea Blanc, or I guess passing for white.
Yes.
And these are portraits, pictures of black women.
Yes. And it's just to show because, you know, within this country, the one drop rule, we see that kind of black or white kind of thing. You know, one drop makes you black. But in places like New Orleans and Charleston, you had more of a range. And so it wasn't just cut and dry, one drop, you're black. Mm-hmm. It was all of these gradations. And with each one of these gradations came differing levels of privilege in the community.
And some people, of course, then could pass into the white community.
Yeah,
unbeknownst.
Yeah, and passing is an interesting concept,
you know,
in that it really speaks to the idea, and I always tell my students that none of this is real, right? It's about people's perceptions. It's about people's definitions. It's about, you know, he or she who names has the power. And so what's interesting when we talk about black racial identity for so long, particularly in this country, it hasn't been black people who have been defining our identities. It's been the white society. And their investment in defining our identity had much to do with maintaining power and isolating power within a particular group.
But what's interesting, and I think your book speaks to this, which is these are all people in this book who call themselves some version of black. And yet I have to say, as a white person looking at them, I mean, sometimes they look black. Sometimes they look like something else.
And it's the question, what does blackness look like?
Exactly.
So what is that? And so for me, it's really about challenging that. And again, starting with myself, you know, coming to Philadelphia from New Orleans, I had my own ideas about what blackness was based upon my experience in New Orleans. And so for me, in my experience, most people who, and listen to the language, had the option not to be black or, you know, had the privilege to not be black, chose not to be black. They were Creole or they were these other things. And so coming to the Northeast, coming to a city like Philadelphia and then visiting places like New York, where I'm seeing people who look very much like folks I grew up with who are like, I'm black or I'm Afro this or I'm that. And so I was intrigued, like, well, what does that mean? And why would you want to be black? Listen to it. Why would you want to be black if you don't have to be?
Mm.
And so this conversation with folks in this book is about people who, above and beyond any legal designation or any drops, they're saying, I'm black for all of these other reasons. And this is what blackness means to me, despite what I look like, or maybe even because of what I look like. And so it really challenges us to think about blackness bigger than what it looks like.
Do you think the 60s had anything to do with this, the sort of black is beautiful idea, which is to people growing their hair and saying, I'm a black person and this is what I look like?
I mean, I think the Black is Beautiful movement was the kind of public announcement and the moment where the rest of the world got to know that we were proud of ourselves. But I think we've always been proud. I think we've always thought black is beautiful, but the Black is Beautiful movement was more of a political movement to say, now it's time for you to see it too.
But what's so so difficult, I guess, about this whole notion of skin color is that so many black slave women, you know, were raped by the white owner slash master.
Mm-hmm.
Their children are then born, and perhaps they get some kind of increased status, but it was a birth out of the violation of slavery.
Absolutely. The rape of enslaved African women. But that's why it was so important for me to map out this history in the introduction of the book before getting into the stories, because you know, we all know that many people think that race doesn't matter in this moment. And so there's so many people who have no clue about the history of race in this country. So the one drop rule is coming out of anti-miscegenation America. The one drop rule is a way to discourage the mixing of the races. And what it says is that, you know, Marty, you can be a white woman and fall in love with an enslaved African man and have his child, but no matter what, your child is going to be enslaved. Mm-hmm. So no matter what you do, right, you are the only person that's white in this situation. Even your child can be enslaved, so don't do it.
Well, you even say that the white abolitionists or the abolitionists often used light-skinned slaves or even children as part of their campaign against slavery.
Right. It was part of the propaganda. And so they weren't saying, let's abolish slavery necessarily because it's wrong. Look at these enslaved people. They were saying, look at this white-looking child. Even this child could be enslaved, which is an affront on whiteness as a whole. And so if we want to protect whiteness, we need to protect this child. And so it had less to do about the institution of enslavement as it did with the idea that someone who looked white could be enslaved.
And they even talked about white slaves and black slaves,
yes.
Right? I mean, yes. Those are the words that were used.
Mm-hmm. And really, that was a, you know, in a space like New Orleans, for example, where someone who, quote unquote, look white could be enslaved, everyone in that space did not consider that person white because of these different categorizations. The abolitionists are coming out of the North, and so they're looking at these enslaved children and saying there's no way these children could be enslaved or black because of how they conceive of whiteness. And so it really even shows in terms of locale, and we still see this in America, based upon what region you're in, you can have different ideas of what blackness is or should look like.
You even include it looks like a pamphlet, what miscegenation is and what we are to expect now that Mr. Lincoln is reelected.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a picture of a black man kissing a white woman on the lips.
Right, supposed to instill fear. You know, even if you look at the ways in which that man is portrayed, he's not necessarily looking like an African-American human being. He's more akin to a monkey.
Right.
You know, and it's about instilling fear. You know, the one drop rule even speaks to the ways in which whiteness is predicated on purity, right? And so this one drop is enough to taint pure white blood. And so they were assigning all types of human characteristics to blood. And so that is once you start mixing that blood, you start messing with human capacity.
But you were saying that, and I sort of framed it that this was a more Southern idea, but you seem to be saying this was universal. At least certainly was all over the country.
Yeah, it was all over the country. All over the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. I also want to give out that phone number because we are talking about some important stuff. And again, our guest is Dr. Yaba Blay. She's a Drexel University Africana Studies professor. As I said at the top of the hour, she was a consulting producer for the CNN documentary series Black in America, a segment titled Who is Black in America? And we're talking about her new book. It's called One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race, based on a series of questions that she asked folks who are included in this book about what you call yourself. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, supports WHYY, hosting an historic conversation between Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, and his daughter, Dr. Judith Beck, Thursday, November 7th at WHYY. Moderated by Radio Times Marty Moscowane, the event will run from 6 to 9 p.m. Details and tickets at 610-664-3020 or beckinstitute.org.
At a time when trusted news and analysis is critical to understanding our complex world, your donations to WHYY during our membership campaign is the best reason why we're bullish about the future of public media. This is Bill Morazzo, President. Having a growing number of WHYY members makes it possible to have the financial strength to give you the news you expect from us every day and to grow those services to meet your needs for tomorrow. Thank you.
I'm George Takei. In 1938, families gathered in front of the radio at night.
Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds.
The War of the Worlds is the most famous radio broadcast of all time.
We take you now to Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
And we're bringing it back for its 75th birthday. Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Yaba Blay. Her One Drop project is about her interest in the answers to this question, do you know blackness when you see it? She asked a diverse group of people about what they call themselves, and she got a diverse list of answers. Her book is out called One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. And I should add that an exhibition of these portraits will be at the Painted Bride from November 1st through December 21st, and she'll be speaking there on Sunday, November 10th, part of First Person Arts event here in Philadelphia. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, as someone who writes questions for a living, I was interested in the questions that you came up with, which became the kind of basis for this book. How do you identify racially, culturally, upon meeting people for the first or upon meeting you for the first time, what do people usually assume about your identity? Do people question your blackness? So you had very specific questions you wanted to have answered.
Yeah, I mapped those questions out as a guide. But for the most part, each one of these interviews really functioned as a conversation. And it really opened up a lot of interesting things for most people. And so some people got all, you know, it wasn't a standard Q&A, but just these are my guiding questions to try and get some idea of what their identity meant to them.
Anything surprise you? Or did you see patterns or trends in here?
You know, what surprised me, and maybe it didn't surprise me, I think the surprising part was just having a voice. But, you know, I've done work on colorism for years, and so I've always looked at it from one direction, and that's the disadvantages that come with having dark skin. There was always something eating at me, thinking there has to be another side to this without necessarily knowing what that other side is. But I think if anything, I don't know if surprise is the word, but particularly interested in the ways the conversations with women went. A lot of stuff came out about the tenuous relationship that happens between dark and browner skin women and lighter skin women. And really this idea that, you know, for the women I spoke to, at least, they're not necessarily walking around flaunting a privilege or saying, I'm better than you. But that's oftentimes a lot of the assumptions that we make when we see them. Or to have a woman say to me, you know, if I could give the privilege to you, do you want it? Like, what do you want me to do? Like, all I really want is to be seen as your sister. I didn't ask for this skin color. And so it really opened up a lot in terms of even personal connections with folks.
And these are folks that where strangers do say to them, what are you?
Yeah, all the time. I've even witnessed it being with some of them in public that, you know, we can be standing in the taco line and somebody just walk up and, excuse me, what are you?
Wow.
And I've always been, it still surprises me that people would be so emboldened to walk up to a stranger and not just ask them that question, but then expect an answer.
Well, and I wonder whether it's the person asking that sort of rude question, I would say, but whether it's also how they orient themselves. So if they say, well, I'm a Latina versus I'm a black woman, whether that stranger then sort of orients themselves differently to that person based on what they say.
Yeah, because why else are you asking the question?
Right.
That's my
thing. Is like, how am I supposed to relate to you?
Right. So once I give you the answer, and now what? What are you going to do with that now that we're standing in this taco line and I say that I'm black? Does that change something for you?
Well, I thought it was interesting of the many people that you talked to, they had their own sort of unique way of describing themselves.
Yes.
Black in certain instances, biracial in certain instances, mixed. There was a gentleman that called himself Appalachian African American. There was the Black Latina. This is Lina Delgado de Torres, a woman that called herself a Jamaican, which I guess is Jamaica and American, Afro-Cuban. I mean, these are words that people used to describe themselves.
Yes, and for me, it was very important to honor their own naming of themselves, because again, the power comes in the naming, you know, mm-hmm. and so they all have various stories, but it was interesting to me also that they had thought critically about the names that they would use to call themselves, which is not something I think many people do. Right. Many of us just take the language that is given to us without necessarily right. thinking about what that means. And so I had lots of interesting conversations about folk who will say, I'm Black, I'm not African-American, or I'm African-American, I'm not Black. And so even thinking about the politics of those terms that some people use interchangeably.
Well, you opened to a page of a woman who's Mennonite and Black.
Yes. Something that most folks
yeah,
think
tell
go
us
together.
About her. Yeah, exactly.
Danielle was actually on the CNN documentary, Who is Black in America? They talked a little bit about her story, but she grew up in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, large Mennonite community, predominantly white, mm-hmm. Daughter of a white Mennonite mother and an African-American father. And so in that space, she was very aware that she was Black. She was Black as they come, and then moved to Philadelphia to go to Temple and got all these questions. Well, what are you? Are you Puerto Rican? Are you Italian? What are you? Where'd you grow up? No, you're not Black. And so for the first time as an adult, not understanding how people couldn't see her Blackness when in Lancaster County, people would point at her, like people knew she was Black. And so again, this idea that our identities are fluid, even in as much as we move through the world.
In that kind of different context.
Mm-hmm. That you can be seen as something else, which will, you know, directly impact the experience that you have in that place.
I mentioned Lena, and she describes herself as Black Latina. She says, my mother's parents were from Jamaica and Cuba, my father from Spain, but I'm not biracial. I'm a Black Latina.
Yes. And she speaks, she's also a professor, and she speaks very critically of the language of biracial. You know, she talks about the language assigning an identity that doesn't align with her lived experience, that she's not split down the middle, half Black, half white. And so what does it really mean to be biracial? And so, again, interesting conversations about the language that we use to identify.
Let me get some callers in the conversation. Looks like we have Dorsey from Newcastle, Delaware, joining us. And Dorsey, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I'm calling because I wondered if your guest had encountered, and she probably has, an article in the New Yorker, which was probably at least 30 years ago, about a New Orleans woman who thought she was white and applied for something like a driver's license and was suddenly discovered that she was, I think, 132nd Black.
Yes, I actually
include her. And, you know, there was a case about it.
Yes, thanks, Dorsey. Yeah,
yeah,
go ahead.
I actually include the story of Susie Guillory Phipps in the introduction of the book, who's a woman who, you know, in her imagination, in her mind, in her family history, she was white. She, as you mentioned, she was going on vacation with her husband, so she needed a passport, applied for her birth certificate, and for the first time in 42 years of life, sees on this birth certificate, it says colored. And so, you know, she calls and there must be a mistake. And they're like, no, you're Black.
Wow.
Or you're colored. And so she and her six siblings sued the state of Louisiana to have her birth certificate changed, but then to also rule this one drop rule, 132nd classification, as unconstitutional. And she lost.
And she lost.
And up until 1983, the one drop rule was on the books in the state of Louisiana.
You also talk about the Plessy versus Ferguson case, mm-hmm. which, of course, was before the U.S. Supreme Court, essentially enshrined separate but equal. And Plessy actually passed as white. Mm-hmm. So he bought his ticket mm-hmm. for the train as a white man, but then he revealed himself to be a Black man.
Yes, and it was calculated. You know, it was for the purpose of bringing this conversation to the fore, that if I look white and you didn't ask me any questions and I could have sat in this first class seating, but I am Black. Like, what does this, they were really challenging race, period, at this point in time. We don't necessarily learn about the case that way.
No.
We learn about it in terms of separate but equal. But this group of African descended folks in Louisiana, they were actually challenging the courts on race, on the classification of race, and saying that it doesn't mean anything. We're human beings way back then.
But it seems that Louisiana is sort of a center for some of these questions and challenging these racial laws or racial designations.
Yeah, and I think it has a lot to do with the unique history of Louisiana. There's always been a history of racial and cultural mixing in that space, and so folks have always been trying to figure that out.
And Creole was that thing in the middle, right?
Mm-hmm. It was, they put it in the middle. I put it that way. Because Creole, I've also done work on Creole to come to understand that even people have different ideas of what that means. And so on the books, it can be any mixture of French, Spanish, Native American, African, And you don't have to have all four. And some people say, well, Creole is just about your last name, or Creole is about what you look like. And so it just really it's relative.
That's Yaba Blay, our guest today on Radio Times. Again, Drexel University Africana Studies professor, and we're talking about her new book. It's called One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. And we're taking more calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get, looks like Aaron from West Philadelphia to join our conversation. Aaron, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. Hi, I just had a question about passing specifically for women of color who are trying to obtain degrees. My family has a long history of passing, even to the point where I did a project in sixth grade called The Many Shades of Black in My Family.
Oh, interesting.
And it just seemed like nobody really knew anything, but I have a family of advanced degrees, and it's from the 1800s and on. Because my family passed. Mm-hmm. And so just a little bit, I mean, I think for listeners and also just for me to be able to hear how beautiful that history really is of women of color achieving through passing, and the families that strive to this day on, you know, their legacy.
Well, that raises several questions, Erin, and I'm glad you called into Radio Times, and I'd be curious about your response to that.
You know, it's interesting. It's hard for me. I'm not sure how to answer that question, in the sense that what we know about passing oftentimes is that when people pass, they had to abandon their Black families. And so many families, even one of the contributors in the book, talks about having an uncle who passed, but you don't see them anymore, because in order for you to successfully pass, no one can have any suspicion or connection of you being connected to anything Black. You have to actually assume a white identity. And so, yes, you know, folks who pass were able to, quote unquote, live white lives and have access to education and other things, but it's hard to know, because A, they would have to reveal themselves at some point, and B, that Black family would still have to be connected to them and know where they are. And so it's hard to really talk about what that is, if
well,
that
it,
makes sense.
It does. I mean, I can understand that Erin being proud of her ancestors. It's your family, but it seems from what you're saying that there's a price to be paid.
Oh, absolutely. Because you abandon, I mean, there's an interesting old film, one of my favorite films, Imitation of Life, you know, where you have this young girl who's born to an African-American mother who's very fair-skinned enough to pass, and they grew up, you know, she grew up, her mother being a domestic in this white family, and so she's, you know, one-on-one connected and watching this white privilege and wants it from the time she's a little girl. She grows up and leaves home. And there's this powerful scene where her mother finds her, and she's working in this store, and she's like, you didn't have to leave home. I would have done anything. She's like, who is this woman?
Oh,
you know, she has to perform that even in front of other white people, because if I let y'all know that this is my mother, the gig is up.
You interviewed a woman named Angela Griggs, born in 1908 in Fayetteville, Georgia. She says, my father's father was white and his mother was dark. My father's father owned the sawmill. He never claimed my father as his son, but he did see to it that we were taken care of. My father never laid on us about no yellow, no light skin, or no white, or no passing, or none of it. And she's basically saying, he said to us, we're Negroes. Black.
Yeah.
We're not going to pass.
No, and for him, you know, what I appreciate about her story, he said to his children very frankly, do you see my mother? Do you see her skin color? If you abandon Blackness, you abandon her. And so instilled in them from very early on. And again, it's about the historical moment, because what she also recognized was that her grandmother was being taken advantage of. She was being abused. And that if anything, she needed to align herself with that as a sense of pride, but also as a sense of support.
Let me see what Marilyn from, it looks like Elkton, Maryland, has to say. And Marilyn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I'm a Black Canadian, and my identity happens to be more strongly Canadian because my family has been in Canada for many generations. But I think it's very empowering for us to be able to say who we are. And if that means mixed or biracial or whatever, I think we should claim that. I mean, nobody says that a dog that is part golden retriever and part something else is one thing or the other. You say it's a mixed breed. Mm. And if you say that about dogs, and because that's the reality, then we should be able to say that as human beings. I had a horrible experience in the South where I was told by a white person at work that even though I was foreign, even though I spoke like I did, and even though I was well-educated, her grandmother would still consider me the N-word.
Oh, Lord.
And then someone else at that same job, who happened to be an African-American, came up and told me that I was nothing but a house N.
Mm.
So my empowerment has to come from who I say I am.
Absolutely.
Because the other people, usually it's something detrimental, and it's very, very political.
Well, indeed. And Marilyn, I'm glad you called in. Yababla, you want to respond to
No, I mean, I would agree. I would say that, yes, you have every right to self-identify. You know, and that's the thing about this book, and I think oftentimes people hear the title and assume that I'm advocating for the one-drop rule or that I'm the blackness whisperer, and I'm trying to tell people.
People said that to you?
Tell people who I'm. Honestly, I feel like I'm a conduit of sorts. I'm open to telling people stories and giving people a voice. It's definitely not about me saying these people are black. These are people who are telling me that they're black. And so I'm interested in giving them an opportunity to tell their stories and talk about how they're black. But there are folks in the book who say, no, I'm biracial.
Yep.
Or, no, I'm mixed. There's no way I'm going to say I'm just black, because to do so is to disrespect my white parent. Then there's someone else who says, that's not disrespecting my white parent. They're the ones who told me I'm black. And so it's just an interesting conversation about how people come to their identity. And again, choices and the empowerment that does come with saying, this is my particular naming. One of our contributors says, I'm a black man with a white mother.
Yes, I saw that.
Right? And so that, absolutely right. The power comes in the naming.
Well, in fact, you include Perry DiVirgilio in your book, and he's been a guest on the show. And what's interesting is he calls himself black.
Mm-hmm.
His mom is black. His dad is white. Mm-hmm. Sounds like the mom sort of left the scene. So being raised by his white father, who says to him, be black, be proud.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It was an interesting twist on things, because so often, you know, when we hear about parent absenteeism within this kind of biracial identity conversation,
right,
so many times people talk about the black father disappearing and the kind of longing for blackness that comes out of that. For Perry, you know, this interesting story, having his father, a white man who grew up in North Philadelphia in a predominantly African-American community, feeling very comfortable around blackness himself as a white person, and then having a son who he says, no, you're black, and these are all of the reasons why black is beautiful, that it was his white father who was getting him to feel proud about who he was, while his black mother was saying, no, you're mixed, you're better than them, you're different than them, don't hang out with them. And so for Perry, he says that the strength that he has in his identity, he owes to his white father. And that in identifying as black, he does not see that as disrespectful to his father, because it's his father who told him he's black.
Well, what's interesting, and he seemed to touch on this notion of, I guess, choosing. If you have a black parent or one white parent, let's say, whatever you choose, you know, how will that other parent feel?
Yeah.
Am I being rejected because of skin color?
Right. And it's interesting because, you know, once I launched this project in the public sphere a couple years ago, a lot of the feedback and a lot of the comments that I was getting was from white mothers of mixed children, or white mothers of adopted children, who just really kind of wanted a blueprint. Like, how do I help this child navigate their identity? And I had some very good conversations with some mothers for them to understand, like, this is not about you.
Yeah.
So you can't lay this guilt on your child and saying, well, if you don't do this, then you're rejecting me. It's not about you. It's about them. What do they feel? What beats in their heart? What identity speaks to them? And they should be able to connect with that. And it has nothing to do with a rejection of you.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with our guest, Yababla. The book is called One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. And more calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Mini of the Main Line supports WHYY, featuring the full line of the fuel-efficient, design-for-fun Mini. Located less than 5 miles from the Philadelphia Art Museum at 130 Montgomery Avenue in Bala Cynwyd, and online at minimainline.com.
Ground control to Major Tom.
On the next Fresh Air, astronaut Chris Hadfield talks about what he's seen and experienced on his 3 space flights and 2 space walks. Hadfield is probably best known for the YouTube video of him singing David Bowie's Space Oddity while floating around weightless at the International Space Station. Join us.
Ground control this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The housing guy who sounds like an environmentalist.
The 12 hottest years we've ever had in our history have happened in the last 15. This is not just an anomaly. We have to prepare our communities for these storms again.
HUD Secretary Sean Donovan on why weather and climate make his job harder. More earthly challenges next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
WHYY is supported by Pennsylvania College of Health Sciences, an academically and health sciences-focused institution. Applications are being accepted for an RN to BSN program at Lehigh Valley Health. More information about accelerated courses at pacollege.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking about race and identity with Yaba Blay, and her to-be-published book is called One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. She's a Drexel University Africana Studies professor, and we have an explosion of phone calls. Let me get back to our callers. We've got, looks like, Tiffany from Northeast Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Tiffany. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a very dark-skinned woman. I have locks as well, and I frequently get the question, you know, where are you from? Can I touch your hair in public spaces with strangers, like the guest was saying, in a taco line? And I've never took offense to that question, and I always teach my students, don't make premature judgments, you know, ask. I feel like that's a part of people becoming more culturally aware, is having the ability to ask. So I wanted to ask the guest, what is the fundamental problem with someone asking, you know, who are you, or what's your ethnicity, or where are you from? What's the fundamental problem with that question, and why do you take offense to it? Is it the context, or is it the way the person asks?
I, too, have not really had that experience. But again, for, you know, in speaking to the many folks that I've spoken to in this project, it's about them feeling offended and feeling violated and feeling like, can I just be and walk in this space? But even beyond that, I mean, I get it in terms of this notion, well, you should ask questions if you want to know. But to me, the fundamental kind of question is, what are you going to do with that answer in the taco line? Like, something is compelling you to move to this person that you've never encountered before. You didn't say, how are you? You said, who are you? And so you're a stranger. And to me, and having witnessed this happen, it really seems like a violation of space. So you get the answer and then you walk away. You feel satisfied now to do what? You know, so I think it has more to do with the context, A, and it's, I mean, you can build a rapport with a person and ask that question. So it's not about, we have now met, we've had conversation, I'm curious, I ask. It's about you walking up to a stranger. I had one woman who has albinism, who was standing at a bus stop and had somebody drive up, park the car, get out of the car, take a picture, get back in the car, and drive away. Like, these are human beings that we're speaking about. This is not the World's Fair, right? It's not for you to just walk up to somebody and get what you want from them and walk away. And so I think we have to be more skilled. If it's questions that we have, if we want to learn something, we really need to teach the skill of how to do that.
Tiffany, thanks for the call. Let me see what Lydia from Northern Liberties has to say. Lydia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm totally fascinated by the topic because I'm Puerto Rican. And my family, I look very European, a lot of my family members, but I started doing a genealogy search on my mother's side of the family, and up pops my grandmother, who in pictures looks very European, but when I see the entry in the census, it says she's mulata, and then I see her mother, negra, which in Spanish means black. And so I was shocked, and so I'm talking to my family members, and for my Puerto Rico side family members, they were kind of coy and funny and, you know, okay, yeah, okay. My stateside, we all understood that knowing this, she would not have survived here, given how my grandmother looked. And so it was very curious to me about that issue of the one drop. Well, yeah, then I guess I'm black, but I always grew up, because of the way I look, very European. So it was just so... it was such a contradiction of experience, both for the folks back in the island. I will say one thing. My come to learn that my grandfather did not want my father to marry my mother. Mm-hmm. Now I know why.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And it's interesting. Libby, thanks. Yeah, go
yeah,
ahead.
Yeah, because, and that's why I also include, you know, this kind of global conversation, because when we do learn the history of the One Drop Rule, we have to say that this is curiously and characteristically American, very much connected to the history of enslavement in this country. In many places in the rest of the world, one drop of something else is enough to make you something else. And so this One Drop Rule doesn't make any bit of sense to other people around the world. And so it's interesting to see how this intersects with people's Latino-ness or their Caribbean-ness or what this means and what this looks like in other spaces. But to this question of, you know, the One Drop Rule and who is black and who is white, there's research out of Penn State that shows 30%, upwards of 30% of people who walk around and self-identify as white have much more than one drop. So whiteness isn't pure.
Sure.
Right? And we don't have to imagine whiteness being pure, that there can be a multi ethnicity within whiteness as well.
Lydia, thanks for the call to Radio Times. How much do you think the fact that we are a much more racially diverse country and continue to be beyond just black and white, as Lydia said, you know, she's Puerto Rican, the people from African countries, from Southeast Asia, India, Japan, China, and just looking around, it's just a much more diverse country. Does that change, you think, how we operate racially or how we self-identify or even identify others? Or maybe there's more of like, what are you? Mm-hmm. Because everyone's kind of this mix of genealogies.
Again, for me, it's interesting. I think the shift is coming with the kind of shift with the policing of identity, if that makes sense. And so the One Drop Rule happened in a time where you didn't have any other options. You were white or you were black, period. Those were your two options. Pick one. Now we're in a space where people are given more options. Mm-hmm. Check more than one. Check all that apply. Fill in other. And so the fact, you know, in this moment where we give people option, it seems that people are taking the option, if that makes sense. So
sure.
I actually question whether we are actually becoming more diverse, mixed. I think the mixing has always taken place. Right. It's just a matter of what we were naming that, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. Let me see what Pamela from Coatesville has to say. Hi, Pamela. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I have three children. They're all mixed race. My son is very, very dark. My daughter is very fair. And my other daughter is medium. Interestingly enough, first of all, you might get a kick out of my mother-in-law. When my daughter was born, she's the first one, and she's the light one. My mother-in-law told us that we mixed her good, which I thought was really cute. Anyway, the lighter-skinned daughter never says she's black. Mm-hmm. Like, she says mixed. Mm-hmm. The darker-skinned daughter says she's black.
Huh.
And when they were young, the lighter skin would pick white dolls, the darker skin would pick dark dolls. What bothers me is they both want lighter skin, which really bothers me. One has very tight curls, one has very loose curls. And they're kind of, I don't want to say offended, but they're kind of hurt that Obama keeps saying he's black, because they say, why doesn't he say he's mixed? Like, you know, what? They almost feel like he's not, it's not okay to be mixed because the President of the United States says he's black. And my son once, when he was in younger school, he's 13 now, the teacher called me and said, you need to address your son's lying because he's telling us his mother is white. And I said, she is. And she said, no, he's telling us that his mother is white. I said, I am his mother and I am white. So I went to school the next day and said, stood in front of his class and said, listen, I'm Zach's mother. Which I thought was interesting.
I bet.
I got questions. Yeah. I used to get questions like, they would look at my lightest skinned daughter and they'd say, oh, you have a daughter and you're helping and raising two foster kids?
Wow.
And I said, no, they're my kids. And the phone lady whispered, she goes, I know, but do they have a different father? And I said, no, they all have the same father, my husband. So to me, it's been fascinating. When my daughter was younger, when the oldest daughter was younger, people would say, how she can in the middle of winter? And her friends will say, not mean, I don't think, but they'll say, really, Olivia's your sister? But she's black.
Right. Well, it's interesting.
But no, she's my sister.
Well, Pamela, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I mean, you,
sure.
you're living it, and you raised all the questions we've been talking about.
I mean,
about.
It speaks to how you can have a diversity of skin colors even within one's own family, you know. But it's interesting that she mentions Obama, and that's actually the first I've heard, you know, from a child's perspective, this kind of maybe feeling rejected from the president's decision to self-identify as Black or African-American, to use his language. But, you know, he's an interesting case, and for me, again, it's about how you self-identify. It's not about us telling, you know, anybody who they are necessarily. And for President Obama, he says very clearly and publicly that when I walk into the room, my white mother doesn't come with me. You see a Black man and you treat me accordingly. And we see this happening in politics today, don't we? And so you're treating me according to what you see me. And so I could come in here and say I'm biracial, I'm mixed, and what would that change?
Right.
You're treating me as a Black man, and so that's how I align myself.
Pamela, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I was reading about something you did in response to this little girl, Tiana Parker. Mm. She was sent home from school because of her hair. She apparently had it in dreads. The hair was called unacceptable and faddish.
Yes.
And my understanding is her parents quickly took her out of the school. But nonetheless, this happened, you know, not so long ago.
Not so long ago in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Cutest thing on earth. You see her on TV crying her eyes out. And so for me, you know, knowing that Tiana was a straight-A student, the thing that hurt me to my core was the idea, thinking from a child's perspective, I'm sitting in class, or, you know, I go home and someone says I can't go back to school. Well, what have I done wrong? Your hair. You know, something that is a part of her and something that is reflective of her own culture, and she's being rejected by the place that is supposed to educate her. And so I quickly called on my community, women who also wear their hair in locks or who have daughters with locks, and we pulled our pictures together and we created a care package and sent that to Tiana and her family because I wanted her to know that she can see beauty in her reflection, that we are all out here and that we're all successful. And so there are a lot of people, you know, who say, oh, if you have locks, you can't do this or you can't work in this environment. Not true. So wanted to show her pictures of women and girls who love ourselves, love our hair, and are successful doing so.
Did you have a chance to meet with her, Tiana?
I haven't met her, but I talked to her on the phone.
Yeah.
I talked to her on the phone probably a week after the incident happened. And, you know, she's a 7-year-old, so
sure.
One word answers, yes, no, I'm fine. But, you know, I asked her how she was feeling.
Yeah.
And I remember she said, I feel much better. Thank you, Dr. Blay. And so, again, for me, that it was just as simple as wanting her, you know, rather than focus on the school or the adults who have their own issues, I wanted her in that moment to feel loved. And I wanted her parents to feel affirmed that they didn't have to change their daughter's hair for her to go to any school.
Well, she didn't do anything wrong,
no.
Clearly.
No.
Let me see what looks like Sonia from Germantown has to say. Sonia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Can
good morning.
You hear me okay?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
I wanted to say congratulations to Dr. Blay on her book. She's one of the most thorough people I know.
Oh.
She was one of my students once upon a time.
Oh, that's nice.
Dr. Blay, when I was growing up, all the biracial people I knew had Black mothers and white fathers with whom they had very little contact, and they identified completely with the Black community. Today, most of the biracial people I know have white mothers and Black fathers, and in the event there's a breakup, most grow up completely with their white mothers and may feel little connection or identity with Blacks. Yet, in many of the settings, they say... people I know in that situation say that they're often asked to speak for Blacks. And in job settings, they're often appointed to be in charge of so-called Black causes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you have had any encounter with such individuals in your interviews and how they handle those situations. I have students who tell me about this situation, and I'm not sure how common this is.
Sure.
Or
sure.
I think it
Sonia,
is.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Peterson-Lewis. I think it is common. I mean, Danielle spoke about that, but even Noelle, who's the director of photography, spoke about this idea that, you know, and she's Haitian, grew up in El Paso, Texas, and it's that very thing that you speak of, that I'm just Black enough to fit whatever, whoever's quota, that, you know, they can be comfortable with my light Blackness, but it counts. And this tremendous sense of guilt, even that comes, that, oh, you're Haitian and you're a woman and you're Black, and so you meet all these things for us, so we're going to send you out into the field as our reporting journalist or whatever it is, and feeling like, well, that takes something away from folks who could actually benefit from whatever it is that you're giving. And so, yes, being asked to, even though you're quote-unquote mixed or biracial, then being asked to count for Black in particular spaces. And I do think there's an interesting comparison or juxtaposition or contrast that can be made. You know, what's the difference between growing up with a black mother and white father versus growing up with a white mother and black father, even if both parents are in the home? That I think there is something that shifts depending upon who your mother is.
Thanks for the call, Sonia. Let me see what Mark from Phoenixville has to say. Mark, go ahead. Your radio times.
Hi. I'm only 23 years old, so fortunately I grew up like not around too much racism or anything like that. And I'm mixed. I'm Hispanic, white, and black, like kind of all three a little bit. And my grandma's like big on, you know, family history. And I know like all the like different cultures and everything have you know, a very vast history, and they're all very interesting and different and everything. But I wonder in the future, will this subject, not to put down the guest profession or anything, but will this subject matter as much in the future when everyone kind of, you know, is mixed one day? Do you think that could possibly happen, or do you think that there will always be kind of like a divide in cultures, or well, where do you think that will go?
Yeah, let's find out. She's shaking her head no.
I mean, it's hard to project what will happen. So many people have been projecting for so long. We're mixing. It's going to be mixed, but at the same time, the power is concentrated. Even if it is mixed, quote-unquote mixed, the power gets concentrated with those that look most white. And so that's where my work on colorism comes into play, that even in the mixedness, it's about what does that mixedness look like? Because we have codified white as powerful. And so even in that spectrum, you know, the power seems to be concentrated on one end of the spectrum. So it's hard to say. I'm not sure what could or would happen. We do know that in this moment, even in the mixedness, we can use the example of President Obama.
Sure.
Even in the mixedness, right, race still matters.
Well, and what I see from your book is just the sort of gradations. I mean, the very subtle gradations, and then the judgments or the identities that we ascribe to those very subtle gradations of skin color.
Right, because that's the history of race. Race has been predicated on what people look like. And so that's why, again, I take issue with that encounter in the taco line, right? You see something, it doesn't look like something you know. And so you need to know what it is in order to put it in another box. And that box gives you your blueprint of how you're now going to relate to a person, which is problematic.
Well, Yaba Blay, thank you so much for joining us today
on
Radio
you.
Times. And again, Drexel University Africana Studies professor. Her book published...
It's coming out on Black Friday.
Oh, the day after Thanksgiving.
November 29th.
Well. It is called One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. How appropriate
yes.
is that? Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Adam Staniszewski, our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, his debut performance on Radio Times. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for those phone calls, and thanks for joining us.